News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. A victory of words at Dubai. The unfolding crisis around USA to Ukraine. And Europe is moving farther to the right on energy and immigration. A victory of words at Dubai. While environment ministers and other officials from over 200 countries were falling all over themselves with congratulations on the COP28 climate deal, objective observers came away with very different feelings. Fossil fuels will not be phased out. They will be transitioned out. Countries are supposed to submit detailed plans in 2 years on how they will do that, but no one can force compliance if they don't, and many won't. 39 small island nations were not in the room when the final deal was struck. A few will disappear by the next COP. And the final agreement does not include a ban on building new coal-fired plants in deference to China and India. Here's what Al Gore had to say, quote, "The decision at COP28 to finally recognize that the climate crisis is, at its heart, a fossil fuel crisis is an important milestone, but it is also the bare minimum we need and is long overdue. The influence of petrostates is still evident in the half-measures and loopholes included in the final agreement. We must ask ourselves, how much longer will the world have to wait before all nations summon the political will to overcome these narrow special interests and act on behalf of the future of humanity? It is up to all of us to hold our leaders accountable to their promise to transition away from fossil fuels once and for all." As usual, the economically most vulnerable countries got the short end of the stick. They're supposed to abide by the final agreement, but expect only limited financial help to do so. The text calls for a transition away from fossil fuels in this critical decade, but the transition is not funded or fair, said Mohamed Adao, director of Powershift Africa, an environmental group. We're still missing enough finance to help developing countries decarbonize, and there needs to be greater expectation on rich fossil fuel producers to phase out first, he said. Sultan Al Jaber, the United Arab Emirates State Oil Company executive who chaired COP28, was credited with steering the conference to an agreement. Yet that same company is banking on fossil fuels for some time to come, quote, says the New York Times, investing at least $150 billion over the next 5 years to increase drilling. Hard to see how humanity won when his company and all the major oil companies are recording record profits and investing more than ever in new drilling, including in the United States. And when greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels are still rising despite all previous pledges to do more. The science-defined goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels seems no more within reach after COP28 than before. The unfolding crisis around USA to Ukraine. It is becoming increasingly obvious that, one, Ukraine's counteroffensive has failed to deliver any territorial gains. Two, Putin is becoming ever more optimistic about winning. And three, more U.S. military aid to Ukraine isn't going to happen for some time. Thus, we have reports of U.S. efforts to press upon Ukraine the need for a new strategy that would be budget conscious and more defensive. As the New York Times reports, quote, Ukrainian generals and senior civilian officials have unrealistic expectations about what the United States will supply. They are asking for millions of rounds of artillery, for example, from Western stockpiles that do not exist. American officials say Ukraine will have to fight on a tighter budget. Some in the U.S. military want Ukraine to pursue a hold-and-build strategy, focus on holding the territory it has and building its ability to produce weapons over 2024. The United States believes the strategy will improve Ukraine's self-sufficiency and ensure Kyiv is in a position to repel any new Russian drive, unquote. Will Ukraine's President Zelensky buy into that strategy? His visit to Washington last week reportedly did not sway any Republicans and break the logjam that is preventing Biden's $60 billion military aid bill from passing. Republicans are determined to wring concessions on immigration from the administration before they relent on the aid package. Biden expressed optimism about the war, but was not optimistic about finding alternatives for aid. As observers were quick to note, Biden did not say, as he usually did, that the U.S. would provide weapons as long as it takes. The revised phrase is, as long as we can. Vladimir Putin faces no such problems. A new research paper on Russia's military spending shows that Putin is prepared to spend whatever it takes to win the war. Russia's military budget for the new year will be 29% of the total government budget, or about 7.1% of GDP, a really extraordinary amount. Putin is clearly willing to restrain social and economic spending in order to prosecute the war. Europe is moving farther to the right on energy and immigration. Politics in the European Union provides a good example of how the best intentions in dealing with climate change can be thwarted. A European Green Deal aimed at fighting climate change has run into far-right opposition that is tying alternative energy to elitist politics. Just when it seemed that the EU was playing a leading role in abandoning fossil fuels and nuclear power, the far right has, with considerable success, stopped or watered down regulations in support of a green economy. Even the more moderate leaderships, such as in France, have had to alter their positions on the Green Deal in order to keep their ruling coalitions intact. As one writer puts it, quote, today, conservatives across the region believe there's more to be won obstructing climate policies alongside the hard right than supporting them. In part, this shift in European conservatism is a response to a vibrant hard right that has managed to tie climate legislation to effete urban liberals, unquote. We see the same caving into the far right on immigration. A European writer observes that the far right and the center right now seem to share, quote, a civilizational vision of a white Christian Europe that is menaced by outsiders, especially Muslims, unquote. The writer goes on to observe that, in contrast to its progressive image, the European Union has, like Donald Trump, sought to build a wall, in this case in the Mediterranean, to stop migrants from arriving on its shores. France's new immigration bill is a perfect example. President Emmanuel Macron has ditched his promise to defend a liberal immigration policy against criticism from the right. In order to win support in Parliament for more restrictive immigration rules, he acceded to the far right's demands. Now Macron is in trouble with his own coalition. Asylum is a central issue throughout Europe. In just the first half of this year, around 500,000 people sought asylum, and about 40% succeeded. But across much of Europe, resentment has grown over asylum seekers as well as economic migrants, and the far right has exploited that resentment. To combat the far right, the European Union has just now passed a new pact that affirms the right of asylum while putting in place mechanisms for ensuring that applications are genuine and for deportation. But human rights groups regard the new EU pact as a setback for asylum, as well as for failing to deal with all the people who die trying to reach Europe by sea. Since 2014, more than 28,000 people have died at sea as they desperately tried to reach Europe. Human Rights Watch said earlier this year that the bloc's policy could be summed up in three words: let them die. This offshoring of violence, as one writer calls it, is highly selective, welcoming millions of Ukrainian refugees, but literally paying off authoritarian regimes in North African countries to stop migrants from sub-Saharan Africa from reaching Europe. That approach, which finds the center and far right in agreement, salvages its self-image as a strong supporter of human rights, which is central. But let's keep in mind that Britain's government, which has tried paying off Rwanda to keep potential immigrants at home, was stopped by court action on the grounds Britain was violating international law. Perhaps the EU judicial system will step in with a similar ruling. In other news, Ukraine's entry into the EU gets underway. Ukraine's application for EU membership is now being considered after much delay, mainly caused by a threat to block it by Hungary's authoritarian leader, Viktor Orbán. A unanimous vote of the 27-member EU is required for enlargement of membership. Orbán had indicated he would not only vote against Ukraine membership, but might also vote against an EU economic aid package for Ukraine, worth about 50 billion euros. He abstained on the first, but voted against the second. President Zelensky of Ukraine was overjoyed nevertheless, saying the path to EU accession is, quote, a victory for all of Europe. The aid package will have to be addressed sometime down the road. Orbán argues that Ukraine is, quote, one of the most corrupt countries in the world. But everyone knows that his closeness to Russia is central to his views on Ukraine. Perhaps his abstention on the key vote was made possible by what amounts to a bribe, i.e., the release of about 10 billion euros that had been withheld from Hungary because of Orbán's tight control over his judicial system. Hacked, a major nuclear repository in Britain and U.S. government sites. The largest nuclear waste and decommissioning site in Europe, Sellafield in Great Britain, has apparently been hacked by Russia and China. The plant, housing nuclear materials of extraordinary toxicity, is the final resting place for Britain's nuclear weapons waste, as well as for the nuclear waste of a few other countries in Europe. Sellafield has long been a cybersecurity problem for the UK. Chinese hackers are said to be very busy working on US targets, specifically critical infrastructure in the Department of Defense and other US government agencies. One senior U.S. cyberspace official describes China as, quote, the number one geostrategic challenge for the United States, both broadly and then absolutely within the cyber realm, unquote. That puts China ahead of Russia, North Korea, and Iran. FBI Director Christopher Wray elaborates, saying, quote, the scale of the Chinese cyber threat is unparalleled. They've got a bigger hacking program than every other major nation combined. He told a House committee in April, quote, if each one of the FBI's cyber agents and intelligence analysts focused exclusively on the China threat, Chinese hackers would still outnumber FBI cyber personnel by at least 50 to 1. Gazans prefer Hamas. According to the most reliable polling in Gaza, as well as in the West Bank, conducted jointly by a Palestinian and a German group, Hamas is regarded far more positively than any other organization or country. Contrary to what we might expect, Hamas is supported for attacking Israel on October 7 and is not blamed for Israel's retaliatory destruction of Gaza. Few people were aware of Hamas's atrocities. Hamas is preferred by a large margin over the Palestinian Authority if elections were held. Of greatest significance, those polled overwhelmingly believe continued armed resistance to Israel is preferable to a two-state or any other political solution. Finally, human rights in Iran. A street vendor who dances for the joy of it in public has become the center of a popular new rage in Iran, but at the high risk of arrest. Video of the man's dancing has gone viral, igniting a wave of joyful dancing. Not just individual, but also, and contrary to the authorities' regulations, between men and women. Many people have been detained by the morality police. Meantime, two high-profile arrests demand attention. One is of Narges Mohammadi, the Iranian human rights activist who won this year's Nobel Peace Prize. She began a hunger strike after she was denied hospital treatment for two blocked coronary arteries, her family said. The other is an EU official from Sweden who has been in prison for 600 days, still awaiting trial on the charge of spying for Israel. Johan Floderis faces a possible death sentence. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertoff. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For many of us, the holiday season means multiple viewings of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and there's no shortage of films and stage productions to choose from. We're especially favored here in Portland with a version that comes directly from Mr. Dickens himself when he performed the story before live audiences in Victorian England. That's the long-running one-man show, A Christmas Carol, a Victorian reading, with actor, writer, artist, and teacher Tom Bray in the role of Charles Dickens. Tom recreates the public readings of A Christmas Carol that Dickens performed from 1849 until his death in 1870, and Tom's bringing the show back this year to Portland's Coho Theater for two performances on Saturday, December 23rd, the eve before Christmas Eve. Tom's here with us now to talk about the show, Dickens' own readings, and the enduring appeal of this holiday classic. Well, Tom, the last time we talked was December 2020. That was peak pandemic. And since theaters were closed, most of us were sheltering at home. You live streamed your performance of A Christmas Carol that year. Is this Saturday the first time you'll be returning to the stage as Dickens?
Yes, I haven't been back on a stage since that time. And I've been very anxious to do it. Yeah, I used to do it in a much bigger hall. I've done it at the old church for years and years downtown, and then at the Congregational Church on the park blocks. And I'd always wanted to kind of rethink it and think what it would be like in a much smaller space, a much more intimate space, the kind of places that I had been used to playing in Portland, like the old Profile Theater space on Belmont, and just these small little 99-seat houses. And Coho is one of those spaces. So when the opportunity to do that arose this year, I thought, well, let's reconceive this and see what it'll be like in that space. And it kind of fits with the Dickensian theme of a tale told around a fire, just kind of like the streaming performance did. It's much more intimate. When Dickens first wrote Christmas Carol, the first time he ever gave readings were to private parties of friends, where he would just gather around and just, you know, he was a ham.
At his house?
At his house and at friends' houses and like at small clubs, you know, that gentlemen belonged to. And and he would give readings and enjoyed it because he loved amateur theatrics. Many people said that if he had not been a writer, he would have most certainly been an actor. And in fact, Dickens actually scheduled an audition early on in his career, and I think it was in the 1830s, to audition for a stock company. But the literary world was saved from Dickens as an actor because he had a cold, and he could not attend the audition. And by the time the next audition rolled around, he had already become a success as a newspaper reporter. So his writing career had launched.
Yes, the perfect step from actor, huh?
Exactly.
Now, this holiday, going back that far, this holiday season actually marks the 180th anniversary of A Christmas Carol. It first appeared in print on December 19th, 1843.
Right.
So just a few days ago.
Right.
It was an immediate success, no surprise. But unlike Dickens' previous work, it wasn't serialized. It came out in its entirety.
That's right. That's right. And he self-published it, which was something kind of new for him, and basically broke even on the first printing of it because he insisted that everything be, you know, perfect. He got the illustrator he wanted. And he made sure that the plates were in color, and that the book was had this beautiful, you know, bound with gold leaf and the whole deal. And it cost a lot of money, and so he barely broke even for his first printing. But by 1844, it was into like something like three or four printings. I mean, it just took off after that. It was a tremendous success.
Now, you mentioned some of those early readings, which were really just for his friends in his house or their houses before a nice holiday fire. he started that in 1849, but he continued until his death in 1870, and I'm sure he played bigger audiences. Was that unusual for the time, a famous writer performing his own work that predated Mark Twain?
Yes, it was rather unusual. Thackeray had performed his own readings for profit, and that was the real question. Dickens started doing charity readings in about 1853, and he was up to two or three readings of Christmas Carol. And by that point in Dickens' life, he was a mess. His literary powers, he felt, were failing him. His marriage had fallen apart, and he really needed a shot in the arm to do something different. So he kept saying to his close friend, "Well, what if I did what like Thackeray did, and I did it for profit? Because I mean, it was clearing like £2,000 for charity each performance." And so he's thinking to himself, "I got a new house here. I got to support, you know, this huge family and my mistress. So what am I going to do?" And so he was advised not to do it. They thought that it would be déclassé, but he did it. And so in 1858, on or around there, he began doing performances for profit. And he was very nervous that the public wouldn't accept him because it was a huge scandal, his marriage breaking up. But they didn't care. They just wanted to hear Dickens read. And it was the Carol was by far the most popular book that he read. And he adapted the text, you know, reading is to say it was a reading is the broadest sense of the term. It was really a performance because
that's what I was going to ask you. As this amateur actor who wanted to go professional, he probably wasn't a dry reading before a lectern.
No, not at all. In fact, the accounts of his reading, it was, you know, the voice would change when Scrooge came on. The voice was cold and caustic and you know, he did all the voices and he had them basically eating out of their hand, you know, tears and because really his books were melodramas. If you strip out the irony and the humor, his stories are they're theatrical melodramas. He thinks in terms of the theater in the way he writes, and so it was well suited to be adapted for a stage reading. And Dickens had been on stage as an amateur performer. In fact, he loved to produce amateur theatricals, and so he was well attuned to being in front of an audience and knew how to hold their attention. And this was, I mean, it was no exaggeration to say that Dickens was the solo performer of the Victorian era, of that period. I mean, he was the guy to go see, and he toured America too. So it was hugely popular, and right up to his death, he was performing, even almost on death's door.
Now, you first performed A Christmas Carol, a Victorian reading in Portland in 2004, Tom, and you used Dickens' original script. How did you find that? That was published in a book somewhere or available in a library?
You know, the New York Public Library had a copy of that reading text that Dickens had printed and then marked up with his own manuscript hand. And it was reprinted.
Oh, with stage directions for him?
And even directions as to where he would pitch his voice. You'll see sections where it'll say low and then high and then exuberant. You know, he'll have like margin notes. So I use that as it's not quite accurate to say it's entirely Dickens' reading copy because, and here's why. When Dickens read The Carol, he cut out a lot of the social commentary. And the reason he did that was he was still writing, and he wanted his theatrical experience to be, his reading experiences to be kind of frothy and fun for the audience. And so he took out a lot of that scolding of his audiences for, you know, the treatment of the poor and children, et cetera, because he felt that that was left for his pen, because he was still writing books. But to our modern ears, if we were to see Christmas Carol and that, you know, ignorance and want and all of that was left out, we would
Yes, it's a very powerful social statement.
Exactly. We'd feel cheated by that. It's absolutely necessary to have that stuff in, the Dickens message and scolding of Victorian rich for their treatment of the poor. And there's a lot of stuff that would mystify modern audiences, you know, a lot of figgy pudding and things like that that we just don't, you know, it's not going to delight us the way it did Dickens' audiences. So I trimmed some of that back and put back in the social commentary. So it's a kind of a nice balance of Dickens' original script and then just restoring some of the things that make the Christmas Carol a Christmas carol for us in modern times.
Has your script changed, your performance and reading changed at all since the first one in 2004?
Yes.
Based on audience reaction or what's happening around us, maybe putting in some of that more of that social commentary.
Exactly. It has. And I have put in more social commentary. And I'm reminded of Hal Holbrook, who was a friend and who encouraged me to do this. And you know, his performances of Twain would be different depending upon what was going on in the world. He had a lot of material he could plug in as a commentary for what was happening. And Dickens offers us that opportunity in Christmas Carol, too. So I have kind of retooled it for, you know, in certain years and put the things in that I felt were extremely relevant and messages that I thought we should hit for the time.
And how did you get into the role of Dickens to kind of channel Dickens in your performance? Maybe you talked to Hal Holbrook about how he did it with Mark Twain, but I was wondering if there's any written accounts at the time of people who were in the audience and describing Dickens' performance.
Yes, there were written accounts of Dickens' performance and performances in general, but there are some published books that are basically diaries, like almost like a videotape in words, a transcription, if you will, of the way Dickens performed. And so there were a lot of clues there. Of course, as a performer, you just have to kind of do what you think is best for a modern audience. But surprisingly, one of the accounts is actually Mark Twain, who was not impressed with Dickens at all.
Was he a little bit jealous and malicious in there, or just kind of typical Mark Twain?
his criticism was he felt Dickens' voice was weak. And kind of, you know, thin and not very exciting. And perhaps he saw him, I think by the time Dickens hit America, he was older and he was sick. And he might have caught him on one of those nights where he was just not feeling well. I mean, he was dying of congestive heart failure. Clearly, that's probably what it was. And it might just not have had the energy that night for Mr. Twain.
Something for Mark Twain to kind of jump on then.
I don't think Dickens ever saw his stand up act. So I don't think Dickens had.
It could have been a little rivalry there.
Exactly.
Now, Tom, you've had a long and successful career as an actor, a screenwriter. You teach story and screenwriting. What do you think makes A Christmas Carol so successful, so enduring as both a story and a performance piece? You mentioned the melodrama parts of it, and I think in the past you've also mentioned it's also a ghost story, which
it
gets our attention.
Yeah, indeed. It is there is a grand tradition of holiday ghost stories in Victorian times. And of course, Victorians loved ghost stories. I mean, if you think about it, the early Victorian period, it's a world lit only by fire. So if you've ever been in a place where it's just fire illuminating things, you know that in the corner there, there's a ghost, you know, in the flickering of that candle. So
right, a dancing flame.
Yeah, and with death so present to the Victorians, it was not hard to imagine that they would have had a fascination with ghosts. And so, yes, Dickens conceived this as basically a ghost story, the haunting of a man. But I think the genius of the story is that I think as human beings, we love, and we can see it in our politics too. I mean, we love a redemption story. We love someone who has been redeemed from point A to point Z. And certainly Scrooge is that, someone who has completely changed overnight from, you know, the covetous old sinner to someone who was, a good friend to all. So I think that's the eternal appeal of it. I mean, it takes place at the end of the year because it's the holiday. And, you know, we reflect at New Year's on ourselves and just on our own journey in life. And I think that Christmas Carol frames that for us as as our own self-reflection of where we are and what we want to change and Do we have time to do that? And the reminder that we better take the time, because that, you know, shrouded figure of the ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, you know, pointing down to the gravestone, is there to remind us that that time is not eternal, that we only have a certain amount of time to do good for our fellow man. And I think that people want to do that, and I think that's the eternal appeal of Christmas Carol.
Well, Tom, again, many thanks for joining us today. I wonder if Mr. Dickens would be kind enough to leave us with a few words of holiday cheer.
Sure, absolutely. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
We've been talking with Tom Bray, who will be performing the Portland holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, a Victorian Reading, this Saturday, December 23rd, at the Coho Theater, 2257 Northwest Raleigh in Portland. There will be two performances at 2 p.m. and again at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets at cohoproductions.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO's end-of-year campaign is happening right now. We invite you to donate and become a member today. We have the full spectrum of ways to join.